Today's the 27th of April, 2008. We continue with the secret lesson of the fifth course on popular Buddhism. Before we begin the lesson, we pray the name of the Buddha three times. Namo Bonasu Thikkhamo Niyafat Namo Bonasu Thikkhamo Niyafat Namo Bonasu Thikkhamo Niyafat. We continue with the secret lesson, which is the history of Buddhism in China. Last lesson we have learned about the history of Buddhism in India, which originated the Buddhism. Now after that, Buddhism spread from India to all over the world. But of course we have learned that it spread mostly now to the north and to the south. By north and south we mean also the east and west also. Now spreading to the south, it only encompassed Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka, later on, you know, it will go also to Indonesia, Myanmar, Thailand. The north of Buddhism, that is spreading to the north, it will go first, you know, to the Kashmir, Afghanistan, Persia. Somebody, you know, thought it went also to Greece. But probably not. The Greeks only brought Buddhism back to them. Under the Alexander the Great, he conquered some countries like Afghanistan, and they assimilated some Buddhism. By spreading to the north, Buddhism encompasses the Silk Road. Do you guys know the Silk Road? Silk Road, you know, is like a trade road. The Silk Road. Silk Road is like a trade road, which came from Cathay to Roma. Cathay means China, and Roma means Italy. Right? Italy in the time. There was no Italy in the time. It was only the Republic of Roma. That was a republic. So this trade road coming from all the way from China to Rome to Italy was called the Silk Road. The Silk Road, why? Because they import mostly, you know, the silk to Roman. Because you remember in the time, the Roman, the Europeans at the time, they didn't know the silk. So although they were wealthy, they had money, but their clothing, you know, was kind of rough. There was nothing, you know, like a smooth enough. So until, you know, they know about the silk from China, they called them Katai. So with the silk, you know, the ladies, you know, like a lot. And in fact, you know, they say that in the time, the price of silk, you know, was like more expensive than the price of gold. But of course, you know, the silk, you know, was light. So, and the ladies, you know, like to wear silk, especially in the summer. So they call them the Silk Road. The Silk Road, you know, encompasses all the country from China through all the what we call by the Middle Asia and the countries, you know, from the Loya, from the desert of Samarkand. You should learn about that because this is a big history. These countries, you know, play a big role, you know, at the time until they developed the maritime road, that is the sea road. In that case, you know, the sea road deteriorate and eventually disappear. The north of Buddhism spread from India to all these countries, Ladakh, Sikkim, Bhutan, okay, and to the north, Afghanistan. There was no Afghanistan at the time, but they called them the Kushan Empire. The Kushan Empire belonged to some kind of people. We call them the Bactria. You have to study about the history of the world to know about these. Many countries have disappeared, and many countries, you know, rise up. We learn later about that. And then, you know, it eventually, with the Silk Road, Buddhism comes to China. Now we see it here. After division of Indian Buddhism into the northern or Mahayana the Southern or Hinayana, the biggest and most important country nurturing and spreading the Mahayana in China. You understand the biggest difference between the Mahayana and the Hinayana, right? That is big vehicle and small vehicle. We have said many times, I just repeat them. If you didn't get it, Mahayana means the big vehicle, means salvation for all the sentient beings. Hinayana means small vehicle, salvation for only him or herself. So Hinayana is not a pejorative term. It is good. If you practice Hinayana, really practicing it, you can get salvation, you can get deliverance. But it's only for yourself. You will become a good monk, a good nun. But that's it. Mahayanis mean that you don't care about yourself that much. You take care of all the world, of all the sentient beings, salvation of all sentient beings. Now, we go to this main subject. Of course, this lesson in the world was written by the monks of the Unified Buddhist Church at the time, 1955. So basically, you know, they assume that you people, you guys, know something about Chinese Buddhism. Because Vietnamese Buddhism, was like an imprint of Chinese Buddhism. But now, I know that most of you guys don't know anything about Vietnamese Buddhism. You don't even go to pray. You don't even practice. So how do you understand anything? So if you don't understand anything, we have to add something here. That is the history of Buddhism in China. The Buddhism in China spread to China from the Han dynasty. You know the Han? The Han Ming Ti, we say it later on. But basically, the people from the Western countries of China, because China was big. China, Xinjiang, Tân Cương, is in the West, mostly in the desert. And these countries, these people know about Buddhism before the Han. That is the race of the Chinese, real Chinese in China. I mean, mainland China, the part where we know mostly China now. But the people who live in the west of China at the time already knew about Buddhism. Until Han Ming Ti. Han Ming Ti, was in like a 4th century before Christian era. So Han Ming Ti, later learned about this Buddha. Because you remember, we learned about that before, right? Last time. Kanishka, had the money, the gold money imprinted with the Buddha. That is the name of the Buddha with the picture of the Buddha and on the verse, his picture and his seal. So Chinese know about that, know about this Buddha, that is Buddha. But they didn't know anything about him this much. They just thought he was like a god, or something. So what was his teaching and thing? Later on, the Chinese learned that most people in the West believe in Buddhism at the time. In fact, there was only Buddhism. There was no Muslim. There was no Christianism yet. At the time of the Buddha, there was no. In fact, a lot of scholars nowadays thought that Jesus Christ went to India and learned Buddhism. But that is something new to decide later on. But basically, Buddhism was the only high religion, real religion at the time. Most of the other so-called religion was just like a superstition or something, you just practice to become like a immortal. That's it. But not real religion, we say, a big philosophy to make you live well in this life and the next one, like Buddhism. So Buddhism spread in, go from India to China. And of course, like anything, foreign, it was assimilated and it was also rejected. But Buddhism, has something very peculiar to all the religion. That is, it adapts to the society, to the people. So Buddhism, in India at the time, when it went to China, it adapted to the Chinese civilization. It transformed. It's like a transformer. Nothing is lost. Yeah. I got a new transformer, you see, very cool. You just push a button and then it transforms by itself. You don't have to turn to twist anything. It's quite expensive, but not too much as fancy man. You look at, yeah, I like Transformer. Real Transformer, not the Chinese Transformer. So, the Chinese Buddhism just adapted from Indian Buddhism. But it transformed. The Indian monk used to wear barefoot, going on arm every day. Now, in China, they don't go on arm every day. They wear good clothing, and they live in monasteries. And they have a lot of different practice too. Praying, burning incense, and everything. So if you just look at it, you see, now, a monk from the southern country, like Sri Lanka, because whenever the Buddhism go to Sri Lanka, it was confined to an island. So it didn't change that much. So some people thought that it was like original Buddhism. So it was good, something very romantic. But it's not a practical. You understand what I mean? It was old. You see, it's history. But now no, you cannot use in present day life. If you are a monk in Sri Lanka, you're not supposed to watch TV. You're not supposed to learn about anything. You're not supposed to even to learn how to read. Because it was in the rules of the monks. So it was romantic, but it is not practical. The Buddhism, when it adapted to the civilization, it spread out. It spread out in China. That was some question, you know, most of the scholars, especially European scholars, just wonder, because Christianism also went to China, but it couldn't spread that much. So how come in the Buddhism, which was alien to the Chinese, was adopted like that? And in fact, you know, it was huge now. Not only China, but Korea, Japan, Vietnam, it was like a national religion. In fact, in a couple of weeks, you know, we have the what we call by the Buddha's birthday. And you know, in the Mahayana country, we still celebrate on the 8th of the 4th month. And you know, in Korea, they still celebrate, and it was very, very big. You might not know about that. Go onto the web, you know, and get. Oh, I thought I'm making this VCD for you to watch it. And there's a festival they call the Lotus Lantern Festival in Seoul, Korea, with the more than 100,000 participants. Everyone, you know, wearing good clothing, you know, and bringing out one paper lantern, a big paper lantern, not a small one, usually in the lotus form. And then with all these, like a cortege, you know, on these, it's like a rose parade, but at night. Or better yet, you know, like an electric parade in Disney World. Right? But all of these, you know, are made of big things, big paper lantern, made with paper, with the light inside. And all these, you know, like they have they made a statue of the Buddha, of the stupa, big patriarch, and things like this. And people, you know, was, and they celebrate for the whole week. If you want, you know, next week, you know, I bring you this VCD. If you want to, it's only like 16 minutes, but it comprises, you know, all the festival, you know, from last year, 2007. They will have a festival this year in 2 weeks in Seoul, Korea. So if you want to go there. It's very impressive too. What I mean to see is that Buddhism spread to all these countries and it adapts. Even now, you know, it goes to America, to the United States, and you see a lot of American people who embrace Buddhism. And most of them don't see anything against it. Why? You see, because it does not go against the local civilization. So Buddhism in China was spread out, and then it compassed, you know, on the scholars, on the studies, and in fact, you know, Chinese have the most Tripitaka collection. That is the collection of the three baskets. And it was rewritten, added throughout the ages. So many different editions of the Tripitaka. You know Tripitaka, right? Oh. Tripitaka means the three baskets. That is all the collection of the teaching, of the laws and things, of the Buddhas, and of the Patriarch. And in fact, China now has the biggest collection of all the world. Korea now has its own. Japanese, they make one. They make one based on the Chinese. Vietnam, we don't have it. We have, in fact, you know, the most Buddhists comparing to them. What I mean is that Buddhism in China spread out that much. But basically, in this lesson, the master teaches that Buddhism spread out and also declined. There was rise, there was fall. So we have to learn from the rising and the falling figures. So don't be surprised that, well, you see that, well, this history is strange. They say only about the rising period and the period of persecution, and that's it. They don't say much about the history of Buddhism in China. But in fact, you know, we will learn later on. Because you remember in this course, we will learn about the ten school of Buddhism, or we call them sect or school in China, in three lessons. And we learn also about the movement of reform of Buddhism in China and in the world. So we go into the lesson now. Beginning period. The Chinese in the West have practiced Buddhism before long. Historically, though, Han Ming Ti sent a missionary to Yue Ti, to Charyan, bringing back Dhammaraksa, Kashyapa Matangya, along with 16 sutra and the Sutra of 42 section. You know the Sutra of 42 section, right? King Tu Thập Nhị Chương. This is a very old sutra. There were like 42 paragraphs. They call them chapter, but truthfully, these are just like a paragraph saying about the teaching of Buddha only. Han Ming Ti, he dreamed the king, the emperor, he dreamed about a golden Buddha. So he sent a missionary, that is, you know, invoice, to the countries on to the west to bring back some people, some monks or someone. And they brought back Dhammaraksa and Kashyapa Matangya, that is two guys, you know, from this country. I put the Vietnamese name in case you can read it. And if you want to find out more about them, and brought them back along with the 16 sutra, 16 sutras at the time, and the Sutra of 42 section. So they were lodged in the White Horse Temple. We call them Bạch Mã Tự, at Luoyang capital. Nowadays, if you go to China, you still see this temple, this very old temple, right? 2,000 years ago, more than 2,000 years. So it's the oldest temple in the whole world, existing, I mean. See, there was old temple, but they were destroyed. This one still exists today. In 148 BC, Anshikao for Parthia, that is Iran, established in Luoyang, a translation bureau translating 35 texts from different Buddhist schools. Anshikao is the prince from Persia. Basically, you know, he was prince of Persia. Real prince of Persia. He became a monk, and then he went to China, and he was very good. He translated and he, a lot of sutra. And in fact, you know, he translated one of the sutra, which is the grown-up still studying today. And we have this lesson, Anapanasati Sutta. It was translated, you know, he came to China in 148. So it was like in the 2nd century. And this, in the 2nd century, he already taught us all this stuff, you know, about Zen, about sitting down, about observation of the breathing. About breathing, we haven't learned about this, the observation on the breathing, breath counting, and things like this. He already brought back in all these. So the Zen, you know, or the these teaching from Bodhidharma were not really that new. See, it was picked up by Bodhidharma only. Because Anshikao was brought to China already in 148. And in fact, he translated 35 texts from different Buddhist schools. Because at the time, there was a lot of Mahayana schools, small vehicle school, big vehicle school, and also some school about the Yogacara. That is about the mind only. So these are quite difficult. And the philosophy of Buddhism was... So the philosophy of Buddhism at the time was very, very like advanced. So that explains why, you know, did the Chinese no respect Buddhism that much. Because learn a scholar no study about Buddhism and they was in awe about all these teachings from India and from the Buddha. He already taught us all this stuff at the time. He already knew about that. So that was the beginning period, establishment of the Buddhism in China. That is, you know, it was picked up by the mostly of the scholars, because lay people at the time, they followed the Taoism. Taoism, you know, means the people who believe in immortality or the drugs, you know, which if they use can, you know, make people, you know, become immortal. So for the lay people, they prefer that. It's like nowadays. Some people who say that they follow Buddhism, but they prefer to do something very easy, or they pray for this, pray for that. All the people, you know, think differently. Then, you know, after that, lay people, I mean, you know, the common people, usually follow that kind of Buddhism. And the learned scholar, you know, follow different kind of Buddhism. But Buddhism started to establish in China. And it got a solid foundation because people, you know, really respect it. So, and then it spread out. It spread out, and then it encountered four periods of rising, of sprouting, of development, and four periods of persecution because people don't like it. Or sometimes just because it developed too much and it become like a decay. It become bad. Like some monks, you know, being starved to do some bad things. That's in the history of China. Now, the expanding period, there was four of them. First period, from the Three Kingdoms to Western Jin. You know the Three Kingdoms, right? You play this game, the Three Kingdoms? Yeah, that's good. That's a big history in China, anyway. And you have to learn it. No, not only, I'm serious, because you learn about the psychology, how to handle stuff in life. And it was big. History about how people behave in the Cao Cao. He was not bad, right? You see, you have to learn from them. People don't change. Well, of course, you try to fight only, but you miss something there. People, you know, who invent the games want you to have fun. But then, you know, why teach you something? Like you see Cao Cao. Cao Cao was not bad. He was a good person. But then, you know, he was persecuted. And some people, you know, do something unjust toward him and his family. So he tried to get revenge. He was good, and then people pushed him to become bad. You see, Cao Cao, later on, he's become really like bad. And in fact, you know, Chinese people regard him very, very low. But historically speaking, he was good. So, you see, the Three Kingdoms. The Three Kingdoms, that is, China at the time was divided in three kingdoms. The Wu, the Wei, and the Shu, right? The Ngô, Wu means Ngô. The Wei means the Ngui of Cao Cao. The Ngô is the one, you know, near the Guangdong nowadays. We call them the area of Guangdong, you know, the Hong Kong area. The other one is in the Ngô. That is the Ngô. We have this here. They are, you know, a big monk called the Kanshan Hui, Khun Tang Hoi. Khun Tang Hoi, you know, was a Sogdian. But he went to Zhao Ti, that was Vietnam at the time. Because you remember historically speaking, Vietnam at the time was staying in China. You know that? China belonged to Vietnam at the time. You don't know about history of Vietnam? In the time of Vietnam, stay in China. Where do you live now? Saigon, everything. Belong to different people. Gotcha. You understand that? Vietnamese, in the time of stay in China, in the lower part of China. And then, we, since, you know, the Viet, you know, want to become independent, they were pushed out by the Han. So, why they go migrate down? They try to exterminate all the people. The Champa, the Cambodian, everyone. Your sister was really, really mean. What I mean is that Khun Tang Hoi, Kang Sheng Hui, in the time when he was like a Vietnamese, and he migrate to the wall, that is, you know, to this part, to this country. So in we mean the one, you know, with Lupi, you know, has a we, and Dhammakala was a monk from China. See, Lupi, you know him? Lupi, you know, was the one who was not really that good, but then, you know, he claimed that he descended from the Han.
Yeah.
So people know, think that, well, he's the right one. The other one was like the usurpators. The shoe, the token, belonged to Lupi. Basically, you know, there was three countries, and three kingdoms, these three kingdoms fight each other. And later on, you know, when we assimilate. So in the period of the three kingdoms, there was monk, Buddhist monk teachers, you know, coming from India or other countries to China. You see? In Wu, we have the Kang Sheng Hui from Vietnam. In Wei, we have Dhammakala from the Siang Road. And in Shu, only, you know, we have the Chu Shi Heng. Chu Shi Heng was the first ordained monk of China. So if you learn about history, you see, Chu Shi Heng, you know, is the first ordained Buddhist monk. Because in the time, you know, if you want to become a monk, you just shave your head and you call yourself monk. That's it. Because there was no teacher. There was nothing, you know, like official. So Chu Shi Heng, you know, went to India and learned about it. He get ordained as a monk. He come back to China, and then later on he come back to India and die over there. And after this period of the Three Kingdoms to the period of Western Qin, Kumarajiva was big one, was big translator. He came to China, and he established, you know, a translation bureau. In fact, you know, he translated a lot of good sutra. Nowadays, you know, we still learn about them, like the Lotus Sutra. He translated a lot of different sutra, many sutra. And in fact, you know, he was the first one who really had a bureau of translation. Before, we had a bureau of translation, like Anshi Kao, but he translated only with one or two friends. From Kumarajiva, you know, was like, you know, kidnapped by the king to his country, because he was really good. So the king of China kidnapped him and then established him a translation bureau. That is, the history say that his translation bureau comprised more than 500 scholars. In a big hall like this, 500 guys, you know, sit down. And then Kumarajiva bring out one roll of sutra in Sanskrit or in other Western script, read it up, and then say the translation. And on these 500, write out and give our opinion. How can they translate better? Or how can they interpret this sentence better? So that was a collective work of 500, more than 500 guys. So the result of the translation was awesome. And in fact, you know, all these, the translation by Kumarajiva was still very respected in the whole world now, in Chinese. Although, you know, it was like in the fourth century already. See, it was old, and there will be better translator later, but then they still respect that. So in the first period of expansion, the Buddhism sprouted up. The second period, in the period with the Southern and Northern dynasty, we call them the Namakyo. That was a big period also. In this period, we have the Bodhidharma coming to China. We have also the Lingvuti. Lingvuti is the king, the emperor, you know, who greet Bodhidharma, come in, and then who ask, you know, I build up, you know, all these hundred thousand of temple, how much merit can I get? And what did Bodhidharma say? Nothing at all. And then the emperor was so unfortunate to say, so who are you, who stand up before me? And then Bodhidharma said, I don't know. Now, Lingvuti was good Buddhist, so he saved, he spared his life. But Bodhidharma has to go up to the north, to the Tungshan. Tungshan, in this range of mountain, where there was a big temple, at the time, Shaolin Temple. He went to Shaolin Temple, sit, you know, to the place. Because he was like an Indian. Come over there. Chinese monk, you know, don't speak Indian. They don't understand a word. This guy, you know, with all the beers, and so then, you know, they pick him because he's a monk. But then, you know, he just sit down and looking at the wall for 9 years. Remember that? But it's the time, you know, Chinese monk, you know, to King Omar every day. And this guy, you know, didn't do anything. You see, that was big period also. Because Bodhidharma was like considered like the powder of Zen. Longwati and many different of the masters. The third period, the Tang Dynasty, that was, you know, a big one. Because the Tang Dynasty, the Duan in China, was big period for literature, for development, everything. In literature or anything else, the Chinese was proud at the time. In this period, you know, Xuan Chang, that Huyen Chang, Đường Tăng, the one, you know, with the pig, the monkey. Of course, you know, they like romanticized it. But he went alone. He went to India alone. See, Huyen Chang, historically speaking, he went to India alone. He stayed over there, learned over there, study over there, and then he came back later. And then he came back later with like a caravan of sutra. So he was greeted by the emperor. But remember, when he left China, there was a decree by the emperor prohibiting Chinese to go abroad. But he was like very accepted. He translated 1,500 books. He was the second one, you know, who established a bureau of translation. Because the king, you know, did to him, you know, like the one who did to Komarajiva at the time. So he translated 1,500 books. And after him, you know, Ai Ching, that is Nghĩa Tĩnh, brought 200 translated texts. Huyen Chang went to India through the Siem Road by foot. But Ai Ching, you know, went to India through the south, that is, you know, through the sea road. And he stopped by Sumatra, we call them Indian Ocean nowadays, to study Sanskrit, and then went to India. So in the time, you know, Indonesia was Buddhist. All these countries were Buddhist. In fact, you know, you remember we said about the Borobudur? Oh, Borobudur is the biggest temple in the whole world, with 9 stories high. It was big like a city. It was big like a city. On the top of it, we have 72 statues of Buddhas surrounding the central Buddha of Lokasheva. This was huge. It was bigger than Angkor Thom. Angkor Wat. It was the biggest temple in the whole world, historically speaking. But it's staying in the Muslim country now. So you guys, you know, don't hear much about that. But if you have time to go over there, Japanese people, especially, you know, they went over there and they tried, you know, to make it like a historic place. Ai Ching, you know, went by the sea road to India and he brought back 400 texts already translated. Because you see, there was a lot of monks at the time in India. In fact, you know, Ai Ching wrote a book where he mentioned, you know, all the names of these monks, you know, he encountered in India, 55 of them. And among them, there was 2 Vietnamese monks who lived in China, in India at the time. Both of them, you know, died in India. But you see, there was a lot of monks. And he wrote, you know, there was some monks from Korea, there was some monks, you know, from Laos. So all the monks, you know, went to India to learn, not only Chinese. So we have also the Empress Wu. Empress Wu, Wu Taksin. This empress, you know, she support Buddhism a lot. Of course, you know, Chinese people, they don't like her. But she did good things for Buddhism. She promote Buddhism. Now, the fourth period of expanding period is the Ming Dynasty. In the Ming Dynasty, there's a special thing about that. That was from the Tang Dynasty to the Ming Dynasty, from the 9th century to the 14th centuries. You see, there was a gap in over here. This gap, you know, happened because Buddhism, you know, was not like a favor anymore. Greek Muslim prefer all the religions, especially the Taoism. Because like we said, Taoism, you know, they have all these things which make you like, when you eat this, you know, you feel good. When you go to the house, the feng shui and everything, you know, feng shui. You go to a house, you know, you shouldn't do this. You have to turn your bed this way or that way thing. And they believe in it, not Buddhist. And people believe in that. But they think that, well, these, you know, bring them luck. Like, you know, even, you know, if you have certain number, they believe in it. Like for Chinese, you know, they like the number 8. Because they call them Pa. It sounds like, you know, Pa in sprouting, developing. So if you have a car, you like the number 8. If you have a phone, like number 8. And sometimes, you know, you feel, avoid number 4. Because number 4, you know, in Chinese, they call them 2. 2 means death. They do believe in that. Buddhists didn't believe in that. But then, you know, they become mixed up. Buddhism, which must survive, you know, become mixed up with that. So people, you know, don't like it anymore. Because you remember, Buddhism at the time was regarded high because of the supremacy of it. That is, you see, Buddhism was big religion, was like a good teaching. But now, you know, if they just teach you something, you know, you just think that it is superstitious, you don't believe it. After the fourth period of the Ming Dynasty, from the 14th century, Zhu Wencheng, Zhu Mingqiong, the founder, was Buddhist novice. He was a Buddhist novice. So when he became emperor, he promoted Buddhism. He promoted and regulated Buddhist organization too. He promoted Buddhism and then he regulated Buddhist organization. That is, you know, he made the like a minister about Buddhism. He controlled that and then he support Buddhism. He gave soil, he gave like paddy field, rice field to the people. I mean to the temples. So temple can survive. He was like a novice, so he promote Buddhism. Of course, you know, after the Ming period, so on through the Ming period, Buddhism was like a very well welcome. And after the Ming died from the king was the people from the west come and invade. They also know like Buddhism, but their Buddhism is a little bit different. Since they belong to the west, they brought with them the Tibetans. They call them the Lamaism. That is, they do more the procrastination, they do more things about the spelling. Instead of the teaching of the sutra, they prefer more about the dharani, the spell. And besides that, you know, Chinese people, most of the Han or the Chinese people, you know, don't like the king because they thought that, well, these are like foreigners who came and invade them. So later on, the king also Buddhist, but more superstitious and Lamaist. So we see this for period of expansion. Now, with the period of expansion, we had also the period of persecution. These are short. They were short. But then, you know, they made a lot of damage. Mostly, you know, because Buddhism, you know, at the time sprout up too fast or grow up too fast. And when they grow up too fast, a lot of lay people, you know, just come in, shave their head, you know, to become monks. So they can get some fame or some wealth. The period of persecution you have on so far, this historically speaking, we call them the Three Wu and One Chu, Tam Bo Nhat Chu. The people who learn from the Three Wu, Wu Ti, Wu Ti, Wu Ti, you see, Wu Ti, Wu Ti, Wu Zong, and One belong to the Chu. So we, in Vietnamese, they call them Tam Bo, the Three Bo, and One Chu. The first period, the Phu-Ti of Wei. Wei in the Ngui. You remember at the time. In 446, he exterminates the monks. That is, he killed the monks. No kidding. He was the worst of all of them. They killed the monks. They do kill. Because he followed some other religion, and then he hate the monks. Because the monks say that, you know, he had to do this, that. He was king, he was emperor, he was almighty. So he knew, okay, so if I kill you, can you survive? He killed them all. king and destroy all the temples. That was the first period. But he was short-lived. So after that, people run away, your cousins, some of them run away and hide. And then they come back. Now, the second period, also the Wu-Ti, Wade of Zhou. He belonged to the Zhou also. There was two Zhou dynasty in the in China. This Zhou, you know, was the first Zhou in 574. He disrobed the monk, and he transformed the temple into the office, gave the temple, you know, to the mandarins, to the officials. He chased out the monk. You go home. That's it. He don't like it. But he didn't kill them. He's a little bit milder than the other guy. But still, he persecuted them. And since, you know, he transformed the temple into the office and given them to all the people to live over there, so the Buddhism, you know, has also been like minimized. The third period, also the Wu. But this was in Wu Song of Tang. You remember the Tang, you know, was like a good dynasty, right? But in this area, the 845, that was in the decline of the Tang dynasty already. And many of these, the king and emperor, they fight each other. You remember this history, right? All the king and emperor, they try to fight each other, kill each other to become emperor. So one of these guys, who is Wu Tong, when he gained power, he followed Taoism. He disrobed more than 260,000 monks, you see. So in the Tang period, there was a lot of monks. There were a lot of monks, and since there were a lot of monks, there was also a lot of temples, pagoda, monasteries. Wu Song, you know, disrobed all these monks. And then, you know, he take on the bell, you know, and on the statue, copper statue, like our statue there, mang them to make money. Because you remember in the time, they made money out of copper. Copper, the bronze band, bronze is copper. And some people at the time, you know, they, whenever they build the statue or build the band, they put some gold in it. Because they believe that they will get more merit and the statue or the band will sell better. So this emperor, he disrobed more than 600,000 monks and melt copper to make money. He didn't kill that much. Like the first one. The first one was worse because he really is killing them. Now, the fourth period belonged to the Chu, to the later Chu. He's not the Wu. Wu, you know, in Chinese mean war. In Chinese, you know, you have the two words, war and van. Van mean literate, and war mean the martial art. Usually at the time, officials or people follow either way. Either you become a literate, you become a scholar, or you become like a soldier, a fighter. That is, you know, if you have power, you can maintain the power. You can exterminate all the guys. If you are a scholar, you use your brain, you have some rules, you use something, you know, to manipulate all the people. So the wolf usually, you know, are the meanest one. Because they are like, you know, brain dead. I mean, not really, but they don't have much in their brain. They have something like this. They have power, but they don't think that much. If they become angry, you know, they will kill people. That's it. The fourth period, later Zhu, at 954, they destroyed more than 30 temples. They destroyed it. That's stupid, right? Because the other guy, you know, he gave the temple to all the people to live. That's better. He didn't destroy anything. And he burned sutras. So this one is a destructor. He just wanted to destroy everything. He destroyed everything. Burned the sutra. And manned the bell and statues also. So he really, you know, made harm to China, to Buddhism. Now you see that the Buddhism in China went through the period of expansion and also the period of persecution. Last thing we have to learn about Buddhism in China is about the Patriarch of Zen. Because we cannot say about Chinese Buddhism without saying about Zen. Because they always think that Zen began in China with Bodhidharma. So these are the six Patriarchs of Zen. You just learn about them. Later on, you know, we learn about the school of Zen in China, and we learn more about that. But basically, they went through only six patriarchs. The Bodhidharma came first. He transmitted to Huike. Huike was the one who chopped the hair, the arm. You know about his story? He chopped the arm, he stand in the snow, he chopped the arm, so Bodhidharma transmitted to him. But there was many other story about this Huike. He was a soldier at the time. So he wears some mala. You know Sutuyin? What can happen? You know the monk, they wear the bed, a string of bed like this. But this guy who came, you know, wear a string of bed made of iron. Made of iron, yeah, because he was like a soldier, a general. And he used to defend himself. So he went, first, you know, he met with the Bodhidharma, he said, Bodhi, hey master, transmit me the mind. And Bodhidharma, of course, didn't say anything. He probably didn't even understand he was Indian. So Huike was mean. He took it out and he knocked it out, boop, and then knocked out two front teeth of Bodhidharma. So you see, whenever they made the picture of Bodhidharma without the front teeth, say that, well, Huike knocked them down. But well, these are like a story. Huike, and then Huike transmitted to Sengkang. Sengkang is the third one. Sengkang was the one who wrote this poem about the Qing Changming, that is, you know, believe in the illumination of your mind. You have to learn that. If you later on, you learn about that. Everybody knows that. And then Sengkang, you know, transmit to Daoxin, and Daoxin transmit to Huineng. Huineng is the sixth patriarch. But Huineng, you know, was the last one, because historically speaking, they say that he was not transmitted, he stole it. Huang Yan. Huang Yan, you know, he stole the rope and the ball from him, and he ran away. But that, you know, that's for later. And these guys, you know, promote Zen Buddhism. So you have to learn about this school later. We have three lessons about the school of Buddhism. Now, the conclusion, Buddhism is a foreign to China. The Buddhism spread due to adaptation. We haven't really said about that. Because if it could adapt, it survived. If it cannot adapt, it cannot survive. It's like us now, coming to the United States. If we can adapt to the United States, we survive. If we cannot adapt, we keep on, oh, I have to go to Vietnam. I have to go to bring money to Vietnam. I have to do this to Vietnam. I have to eat food in Vietnam. I have to eat noodle mom in Vietnam. Whatever. So I cannot adapt to it anymore. I cannot survive. Or, you know, when I die, nobody cares anymore. The Buddhism rise and fall with impermanence. Of course, like anything the Buddha taught us, everything will rise and fall. Will rise and fall. But although the intrinsic reasons were important also. That is, you know, the teacher, the master here say that, well, whenever it spread out, don't be convinced. Like, you know, if you think that you know more about Buddhism, you learn more about Buddhism, you don't believe in all the peoples. You just think that, well, that's not something I'm lucky, I know more, I know a little bit more than myself the other day. That's it. But don't think that, oh, I'm smart and these are the guys, these are stupid. Don't think that. Because things rise will fall. Now, the next lesson we learn about the history of Buddhism in Vietnam in two lessons. So we will start the first lesson next week, and then we have the monk coming in for the Uposatha and for the Buddha's birthday, and then after that we will continue with the second lesson of the history of Buddhism in Vietnam. So we kept the holy. Nguyện đem công đức này hướng về khắp tất cả đệ tử và chúng sinh đều trọn thành.